It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, it's National Suicide Prevention Week. We'll talk about a Wisconsin-based campaign to raise awareness among the country's most at-risk group, men.
First, after months of anticipation over possible executive action on immigration in the United States, President Obama announced this weekend that he's delaying taking action until after the midterm elections.
The announcement came after Democrats expressed concern that they could lose control of the U.S. Senate if the president took executive action. It's a big step backwards, according to immigration reform advocates, and our next guest says it's a prime example of putting politics ahead of people.
Joining us now is Christine Newman-Ortiz, executive director of Voces de la Frontera. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we got this announcement this weekend that the president is backing away from his promise for executive action on immigration. What is your reaction to this so far?
We think it's an unacceptable decision. The president was elected into office 6 years ago on a promise that immigration reform would move first 100 days in office. The Latino vote has been critical in consequent elections in supporting, in gaining support, with the hope that immigration reform would be passed, and of course being very alienated by some aggressive anti-immigrant politics on the Republican side. Under a Democratic Congress, we still couldn't get deferred action passed or immigration reform passed, DREAM Act. And it wasn't till 2012 that, again, the power of the Latino vote combined with pressure where you had young people taking over the political campaign offices you've had a continued organized presence on the ground that resulted in the president using his executive action to pass Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which has helped over, half a million young immigrants to be able to get a work permit and to be able to drive legally and be free from the fear of deportations. That was a good, that was something that helped immigrants, and it was something that did not create political backlash. Voces is not a partisan organization, and our first and foremost are the interests of the immigrant community and working class families, and that is at the forefront. So I think that, it's really shameful that the president would take this advice from some sections of the Democratic Party.
Now, he said that the influx of Central American children that we saw this several months ago has played a role here and changed the narrative in effect, and that this is not the time to be pushing forward immigration reform politically, but also it has just shifted everything so that everything is more pressurized and it's not an ideal time to be doing anything on immigration. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think there's two things. One, first of all, a majority of people do support refugee children fleeing violence, rape, and very extreme circumstances from organized crime in Central America, and who are seeking protection here and in other countries. And that's something that the United States has granted, and I don't see why that would be different for children from Central America than from any other part of the world. I think, again, it represents some real racist politics, and I think it's, I don't believe that, the American people stand by sending children back without giving them due process protections and safety. And in many cases, many of those children had family ties, which is why they were coming here. So looking at that consideration. Secondly, I think President Obama was, elected on a pro-immigrant platform. And, people have continued to, look for his leadership. And we need his leadership at this time. It's not just, what he's basically saying is, we want folks to wait till after the November elections. And what that the blind spot there is the fact that right now we have a deportation machinery that was set up under the Bush administration and continued under the Obama administration that has continued to fuel the only winners coming out of this machinery have been private prisons that are half the detentions go to private prisons right now, like Corrections Corporation of America, the largest one, and to private military contractors that are making a lot of money in this process.
And what about the argument that by waiting till after the elections that the president will be able to do something bigger, and if he has to act now, it's going to be more cautious and tentative. It might not be what immigration reform advocates are looking for.
I think the problem is exactly what I was referencing, that this deportation machinery means part of it is an arbitrary decision by Congress that it's the only law enforcement agency that is required to fill, to detain 32,000 people daily, and as a result is leading to like 1,100 deportations a day. So this is not something where people can sit back, have the comfort to sit back and say, sure, we'll give you that time, because right now under this administration we've had a record high level of deportations. And so like Voces La Frontera, we have a program that just works with families who are who are going through deportation proceedings, and it's extremely traumatic process. I mean, just imagine for your own family, for anybody's own family, that you have a loved one who, someone who's been here for, in many cases, like one of our members, Jose Calderon, who's in deportation proceedings right now. He has been here for 17 years, has U.S. citizen children, has no criminal record, went to court, traffic court, to pay a ticket, and was picked up by immigration there, along with six other people, and is now in deportation proceedings. I mean, and the cost, often it is that the case that it's the male head of household. So you have what is very common, women and children who are, during this time, they're already earning very little money, now have to raise the money to try to hire an attorney, to try to pay a bond, and are going through the trauma of, in many cases, seeing someone taken out of their home or in front of the children, and are really fighting to stay together. And economically, you have people who are really struggling to pay bills. We've seen repeatedly some people having to essentially ending up homeless and having friends provide some kind of shelter, friends or family. So it's a very traumatic experience, and that's what I mean about the blind spot, that he has a responsibility because this administration has also contributed to that. So we're not okay with that. No one at the in the immigrant rights movement finds that to be an acceptable answer.
Looking at those elections coming up that have caused this delay, Hispanic voters have typically backed the president and Democrats in past election. Do you see this delay as something that is going to backfire on the president and Democrats?
I think, particularly in states where you have Latinos who, where you have Democratic folks who are supporting this delay, who are contributing to that decision, there will definitely be accountability. But I think it does depend, each state race does matter. I don't think, like I said, I think often people look at the candidates, versus the party. And so I do think really looking at the candidates in state races or local races, the candidate's position on immigration matters to Latino voters. So I do think, I don't want to treat it so much as a party as much as the candidate.
Christine, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Christine Newman-Ortiz, the executive director of Voces de la Frontera. We've been talking with her about the president's decision to delay executive action on immigration until after November elections.
It's National Suicide Prevention Week, and Wisconsin-based public safety nonprofit Safe Communities is shining a light on the community often most at risk for suicide, middle-aged men.
Across all age groups, men account for 80% of suicides in America, according to the American Foundation for the Prevention of Suicide. And the risk for suicide is at its highest between the ages of 45 and 54.
Men and women experience depression at about the same rate in the country, but the high suicide rate among men is often attributed to a resistance to seeking help, to acknowledging mental health issues.
Safe Communities is partnering with the Colorado-based campaign Man Therapy to raise awareness about the risk of suicide for men and to encourage men to talk about depression and mental health challenges.
Here with us now, we have Cheryl Whitkey. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And then joining us from Colorado, Jared Hindman. He's Director of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Jared, thanks to you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Cheryl, do we know why men commit suicide at a proportionally high rate in this country?
We don't really know why. We have a better idea of how, and sometimes it's about the method that's used, which is sort of a grim conversation. But typically, men are more likely to use firearms, which are more lethal. And also, there's the issue that Man Therapy is trying to address, which is perhaps a reticence to seek help.
And Jared, why is it? Why are men less likely, apparently, to seek help?
Well, that's the rationale of why we developed Man Therapy the way that we did is that typically males are socialized to resist help-seeking, to not express feelings, particularly if those are feelings that are emotional distress. And so the message is you pick yourself up by your bootstraps and you don't ask for help, particularly when it's an emotional issue. And clearly the statistics illustrate that that can be a dangerous thing.
So Cheryl, if men aren't seeking help in ways that are necessarily going to help them, what coping mechanisms are they more likely to use? What strategies are we just inventing along the way?
Well, I think a lot of it is they tend to isolate themselves and not seek help, perhaps drink more, perhaps just... not reach out for help or pretend that everything's okay. And as Jared mentioned, the point behind Man Therapy is to give people an opportunity to look at it differently, to use humor, to draw people to the site and, screen themselves, help themselves.
Well, we've mentioned Man Therapy a couple times, and I looked at the website earlier today. I have a clip here of the fictional therapist on the Man Therapy website, Rich Mahogany, speaking.
Man Therapy is a place where men can come to be men. So here, we won't be complaining, whining, or moping about. No, we'll be getting off our keisters and form-tackling feelings like anger, stress, sadness, substance abuse, and even suicidal thoughts head-on.
So, Jared, very obviously a different tone than we might expect from a mental health website, from a site geared in part to help prevent suicide. How did you try to set that tone? What led you in this direction?
We landed pretty early on this notion of using humor in what initially was specifically a suicide prevention website and what has morphed into also a mental wellness website, knowing that, one, humor works with men and works with everyone, but we also knew we had to do something to get through those barriers that men put up to accessing services or even to listening to conversations about difficult topics. And so we felt that, and we did some research to show that humor is a good way to engage men and to kind of break through some of those resistance barriers that they put up.
And Cheryl, you on your website are pointing people toward Man Therapy. You, at least in part, obviously buy that tone as a way that is maybe, hey, gonna get guys to go somewhere where they wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, I think we have to accept the reality that the current attempts aren't working. I mean, our current approaches are not working. So we have to figure out a different tone, a different technique to get people to the help that they need. When you dig deeper into the site, it's very serious. Mm-hmm. It's really the humor that draws people there. And so we have to try something different or we're just going to continue to lose people.
So, Jared, somebody checks out the Man Therapy site. They maybe chuckle a little. I didn't expect to laugh in a show about depression and suicide prevention, but it is genuinely funny at the outset. But as Cheryl said, it takes you to a serious place. Once people have seen those initial messages, say a man, say in that middle age group, What's available to him once he gets there?
Well, that's what I think where really comes into play is the importance of offering men options. Because, you know, not all men are the same. So some men are perfectly, they welcome professional, traditional mental health services. But we wanted to offer some tiers. So there are things men can do on their own, simple things, like getting more exercise, drinking more water, drinking less alcohol. We also know that one of the things that keeps men from seeking help is this refusal to go see traditional mental health therapists. So we wanted to provide options like here are some online tools that you can experiment with, and here are some other options before you may have to go enter that realm of going to sit on a traditional therapist's couch. But the reality is we also want that message to be very clear that you may be at a point that you have to seek out a professional. And so we also provide a lot of tools for how to do that and what that experience is all about to try to break through some of those myths that many of us, particularly men, feel about traditional therapy. Because for some people, I mean, if you have a disorder of the brain, you can't just do certain coping mechanisms. You actually have to go see a professional. And so that message is very much a strong component of man therapy as well.
Well, and that tone on the man therapy website, in addition to the humorous tone, it's kind of a playful but definitely macho kind of tone. Is part of this reluctance to seek therapy feeling like you're going against the culture's ideal of what men should be, tough, stoic, able to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, Cheryl?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have to just try different approaches. And I think the other thing that's very powerful about the website is it shows examples of maybe macho guys who've sought help and are in recovery as a result. So I think it's very relatable. The people that are on the site and the resources that are available are very relatable to people who may be in crisis.
And I wonder, people in professions, this probably could apply to men and women as well, people in professions, occupations like first aid providers, police, military, A, are people who are in very stressful jobs and most likely need help, and B, be in positions where toughness and stoicism is viewed as an ideal. Do you think that an approach like man therapy could help men and maybe even women in that position, Jared?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, the main target audience for man therapy are those guys, for want of a better term, those manly men who really embrace our cultural mores for what being a man means. And so we find that in certain professions, certainly. But we also built a portion of the site for people who are concerned about a man in their life. So if you're a woman with a son or a husband or a dad who you think may be struggling, there are tools for you there as well, and how to engage that man in your life that you're concerned about and to encourage them to seek help. Because the research also tells us that oftentimes it's the woman in a man's life that gets the man to access professional services. So they're critical to this work as well.
And that reminds me, Cheryl, here in Wisconsin, you are training people on how to recognize and engage with people dealing with depression and mental illness and possible suicide risk.
Yeah, this is another evidence-based project. It's called Question, Persuade, Refer. And it basically teaches everybody, coworkers, neighbors, coaches, lunch ladies, everybody, how to recognize signs and symptoms that somebody may be considering suicide. And it's just an hour training. It's free. We provide it through Safe Communities. And it's been proven to make a difference, to just give people those tools.
And is this up and running now?
Yes.
Okay. If somebody wanted to get involved and get that training, how do they do that?
They can just call Safe Communities and we will send a trained volunteer out to do the training for you.
Right. It's National Suicide Prevention Week. We're talking about the most at-risk group of people in the United States, men, middle-aged men in particular. We're joined by Cheryl Whitke. She's executive director of the organization Safe Communities. That's based here in Wisconsin. We also have Jared Hindman. He's involved with the Man Therapy Project, and he's director of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1111. 1234. Why do you think men have difficulty reaching out for help for depression and other mental health issues? And how do you think we can encourage men to reach out and seek the help that they may need? Are you a man who's had to deal with depression? How did you find help? And if there was a hurdle for you, what got you over that hurdle and into the help that you needed to feel better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your story on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's National Suicide Prevention Week, and we're continuing our conversation now about the high risk of suicide that men face. They account for 80% of suicides in America, according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and middle-aged men are at the highest risk.
We have Cheryl Witke with us. She's Executive Director of Safe Communities, and Jared Hindman. He's Director of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, where they've developed the online Man Therapy program, and you can join in as well. Are you a man who's dealt with depression or other mental health issues? How did you find help? And why do you think it is that men might be more reluctant to seek out help for things like depression or other mental health problems? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Jared, since you've introduced Man Therapy, what kind of response have you gotten? Is there a sense that, hey, this is connecting men to help they need?
Yeah, so we launched this campaign as a Colorado project in July of 2012 with a real focus on changing the conversation in Colorado about how we talk about mental health, particularly among men, and with the secondary goal of changing the way men seek help when they're having an emotional problem. And the reality is because it is an online tool, it got much bigger than we anticipated. We had a feature article in the New York Times when we launched, and so it immediately went kind of national and even global. So since then, we've had 426,000 visitors to mantherapy.org from all over the country, and in fact, from all over the world. We've had some states who have now partnered with us, including Wisconsin, which has really helped us expand the reach of Man Therapy. And the reality is, it's a tool where we can provide options and ideas and tools for men regardless of where they're at. And in fact, the country of Australia in 2013 created their own version of Man Therapy with an Australian Dr. Mahogany. And so the reach has been much, much more than we initially anticipated. We're very pleased with it.
And Cheryl, I was wondering about peers as part of the equation, men helping out men. I mentioned to you during the news that when we've talked to veterans dealing with issues of trauma, a lot of times they say the person who led me to get help was another veteran. Is it important that men talk to men, help connect them with help they need?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's essential that all of us, for one thing, know how to reach out to people in our circle and to recognize the signs that somebody may be needing help. You know, a lot of people see their physician when they're depressed or suicidal, but the people who know them best and are best able to intervene are people who see them every day, including their guy friends or their family.
And Jared, what kind of advice do you have now, having worked with this program, for men who face mental health issues but aren't seeking help? What kind of things have you learned from Man Therapy that might point them in the right direction?
Well, some of the feedback we've gotten on the website is really, it's been affirming in that, hey, this is, one, it's incredibly unique and like nothing we've ever seen before, which for some men is the key. Sometimes mental health speak doesn't work for certain groups of men. And so that feedback's been really affirming, that using humor was a good approach, that providing us with options and tools was a good approach. And so the advice is, if you're worried about a guy, this may not be the answer, but it may be something that just puts a little bit of a crack in a guy's resistance, where he thinks about, hey, you know, I get angry sometimes, or I'm anxious, or I'm stressed all the time, or I'm not sleeping well. Here are some things I can do about it. And the goal is, let's reach these guys before they're in a crisis, so that they have the tools available to them where if things start getting worse or you're struggling with a certain area, this is a place you can come and anonymously and safely find some information and some tools to try to as we initially put it, is try to fix yourself a little bit before you get to the point where you have to seek out professional services.
And Cheryl, suppose a man has taken the step either via man therapy or another way and says, yeah, you know what, I recognize these signs, I do need help. Here in Wisconsin, what's out there for them? Where would they start?
Well, the nice thing about the whole man therapy piece is that there are local links to crisis lines and to resources. So people can go to the Safe Communities site, or they can go to the man therapy site and then be referred to crisis lines if they're there. But then also, just part of the QPR training and man therapy is, how do you help people find help? And sometimes that's something that you do together as a family or as friends. So, you know, the first thing may be talking to your primary care physician if you are seriously depressed and need some, some therapy or some medication even. So it's having the conversation and opening yourself up to that discussion.
And QPR, again, I'm sorry, was?
Question, persuade, refer. So it trains people how to help people seek help. So it doesn't make you a counselor. It's a peer-led program. It doesn't help you, talk them through their problems. It's, how can we get you the help that you need? What are the steps that you can take, and how can I help you get there because I care about you?
And Cheryl, I understand there's a get-together coming up in Dane County. What's going on? How does that fit into this effort?
Yeah, so it's called Guys Night Out, and it's actually based on something that the folks in Colorado launched as well. And it's going to feature Mitch Hank and some stand-up comedy. It's at the Coliseum Bar Wednesday night. We won't be serving alcohol, but the idea is that it's a bar environment where maybe people who wouldn't otherwise come to an event like this would be maybe more likely to come. And so we'll be showing the website. We'll be hearing from Mitch. We'll be hearing from somebody who was featured in the Wisconsin State Journal who struggled with depression and is now and actually attempted suicide and is now in recovery and doing much better. So it'll just be an opportunity to, you know, to talk to other guys, seek resources. We hope that partners can also take this back to their organizations and spread the work out.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Paddock Lake. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding, I don't want to be morbid, but rates of suicide among this particular group, 45 to 54, which includes me, how it tracks with the economy, and if you know economic concerns are a big deal for a lot of families, and I would imagine that one of those big problems for men, you know, trying to fulfill that societal role of a provider would be, you know, losing a job or losing the support from a high-paying job and having to take something less.
Interesting, John. Thanks for the call. Jared, is that something that you track in your questionnaires and things like that on man therapy?
Yeah, thanks for the call, John. And you bring up a really great point. And that's not something we necessarily track with man therapy, but in the data regarding suicide in Colorado in particular, I mean, well, that's what I'm familiar with, so that's what I can speak to. We have the capacity with one of the data sets that we have in Colorado to track circumstances in a person's life prior to death. And so one of the things that we see among this population and among others is recent job problem, a recent financial problem, recent criminal legal problems, things like that. We also know nationally that when the unemployment rate goes up, the suicide rate goes up with it. So that's certainly a factor that can be a contributor when we talk about suicide and suicide deaths, particularly among this demographic, as John described it.
And Cheryl, does that inform your outreach efforts here in Wisconsin?
It does. I think if folks are interested, too, there's been very good research done on the role of the economy in suicides, for example, and there's a link on our website to a really good article. You know, lots of people lose their jobs and they don't complete suicide. So there's typically something else going on, including maybe untreated depression or substance abuse. So it kind of has the economic stressors are there, and they also need to be put in the context of other circumstances.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. We'll go to Dan now in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a very personal subject for me. I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder and was suggested by my doctor to start taking medication to treat it because it was having an influence on my ability to get sleep and function professionally. And I think that one of the barriers you were talking about for men at least, is the stigma of being on psychoactive or psychiatric medications. I think just our society is still not willing to allow people who have mental illness come out from shadow and talk about things like medications they're on or treatments they're receiving. And I was wondering if your guests would comment on that, and I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Dan, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. Jared, that's part of the conversation you're trying to change with Man Therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's people like Dan and his willingness to share a story and to talk about it, which is so critical to this work, because for so long and for too long, it's something as a society we just simply haven't been willing to talk about. And so part of what Man Therapy is all about is not normalizing that everyone has depression or needs psychotropics, but normalizing the conversation that it's okay to talk about these things, just like we talk about other types of illnesses, because we all battle things throughout our lives. And this is just another one of those that too many people suffer in silence with, and too many men and too many people in general self-medicate, which is even more dangerous. And so the willingness to talk about it and to explore options and consult with professionals is critical to this work.
And Cheryl, as we wrap up, do you see this conversation changing in the right direction here in Wisconsin?
I do. I think we have to address the stigma that there's enough that's absolutely the case, that, you know, how is a depression or a biochemical disorder of the brain any different from diabetes, for example? You know, they both have a biological basis, and once they're treated, there's tremendous success rates for recovery in both cases. So I think to the extent that we can get past the stigma that's associated with it, we can make great headway.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And Jared, good to have you with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We've been talking to Cheryl Whitke, Executive Director of Safe Communities here in Wisconsin, and Jared Heinemann, Director of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment.
Safe Communities is a Wisconsin-based public safety nonprofit, and they're raising awareness about this issue. They're hosting a Guys Night Out on Wednesday, September 10th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Coliseum Bar in Madison. You can find more information on our Facebook page.
A look at classic cars here in Wisconsin in today's edition of Wisconsin Life. On a dead-end street in the tiny village of Brooklyn, a former windmill factory now houses some of the most beautiful cars in the world. Albrecht Stuckel is the man behind the wrench.
My name is Albrecht Stachel, and I'm one of the principals in the enterprise of Mercedes-Benz Restoration at Brooklyn Motorenwerke, but we're known to everyone as Brooklyn Motorworks. I was born in Berlin and then immigrated to this country when I was 14 years old. Inside of Mercedes-Benz product line, we particularly work on these rather large cars from the 50s. These are cars that are sort of in the pantheon of automobiles in the industrial world. This is a 1952 300S Cabriolet. And what's fascinating about this car is very early, it's got engine number one in it. Well, they're right here. Yeah, it's 000001. So it's the first production engine for this type of automobile.
Is it imprudent to ask how much a car like this would go for?
About $650,000 in that quadrant. We get the clients where the cars are, East Coast, West Coast, South Coast, and overseas as well. We've done a car for some outfit in Dubai, and we've done a couple of cars for men in India. When I work on this particular group of cars that we specialize in inside of the Mercedes lineup, I think of the individuals who build these cars, and the predominant thought that constantly works in my mind is to honor the lives of these human beings who wasted their lives building stupid cars. And, you know, they went to work every day. They did everything they could to make these remarkable automobiles. And what they got for it is probably an okay living and retirement, and that was it. It took 980 man hours on average to build that car, and today's Ford Focus is 6 hours, so it gives you a sense of proportion. Entropy is our enemy. You know, we're just busy fighting Mother Nature, a fight you cannot win. So it's not all grease and dropping fluids and getting bolts off. It is an intellectual exercise of asserting your intensity to get this piece of chrome flawlessly aligned or this piece of wood refinished in the most exquisite sort of way. I get very involved in that stuff, intellectually and emotionally. Not that I cry, but I get frustrated if things don't work out probably the way I imagined they ought to. I don't look for cars, but at this point in time in my life, they just come find me, like love affairs. I don't have to have affairs with women. I just can't find another pretty car. I'm a glorious 67 years old. Retirement is not an option. As long as your mind is engaged, you are much more alive than you're waiting to sit around and die. I really enjoy what I do, and I hope to just keel over with a wrench in my hand one day.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit the website at wisconsinlife.org and find them on Facebook.
So what's the appeal of a classic car like the Mercedes we just heard about or the muscle cars of the 1960s? Michael Marsden joins us now. He's Emeritus Professor of English, American Studies, and Media Studies at St. Norbert College. He's Interim President of the Popular Culture Association, and he studies our fascination with cars. Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, why do classic cars have such an appeal in American popular culture?
I think it's a really interesting question because just yesterday my wife and I attended a British car show just outside of Chicago in Palatine, Illinois, and it was just row after row after row of classic British cars. No museum that I know of could ever host a collection like that. But these are individuals who own, restore, and lovingly care for these automobiles. And, there's all kinds of reasons, I think, why people collect anything. But if you look at cars in particular, I mean, some people collect cars to sort of recapture a moment of time. You know, they want to go back to their youth, so they want the car very much like the first car they had. If they could even find the first car they had, they would love to do that. They also, I think, as Albrecht said on the interview, that they also demonstrate their control over this manufactured culture. I mean, these are manufactured items, and if you can tear it down and build it back up again and restore it to its pristine condition, that gives you a certain level of control.
Is that common for the classical car aficionado? They don't just own it; they have the hood open. They're tinkering with it.
Yeah, they're mechanics, and they want to get in there and they want to make sure it runs exactly correctly the way it was designed to. And secondly, they want to know everything about it that they can, which is why these car clubs, again, are so popular, because the enthusiasts, can get together, share information, share details, share parts. And they want to make sure it's authentic, just the way it was when it came off of the assembly line, or in the case of many of these cars, they were hand-built. So just the way they were when they were first hit the road. For a lot of collectors, and I see this in some of the people that I know personally who collect, they want to indulge their appreciation for that beauty of design. I mean, automobile culture is all about the relationship between form and function, and there's beauty there. And it's a kind of a true popular culture aesthetic experience when you look at automobile design over the years. They collect for other reasons. I mean, high-end collectors, of course, would argue that they are collecting as an investment. Well, that may be. They also, though, I think, collect what they love, not only just because it's an investment, but they love that particular design or the particular balance between the motor and the chassis. So they're seeking a kind of, I guess, technological perfection.
Now, you mentioned collectors. I imagine a lot of people, because this can get expensive fast, are collectors with a collection of exactly one.
Exactly. I mean, precisely. They can't have a fleet. But they can indeed collect that one car, and they can restore it to perfection or as close to perfection as possible. Then they can take it and put it in parades, or they can just put it on the driveway. And, it's what I would call driveway art. It's kind of what boat collectors do. They call them dock art. They never use that speedboat, but, it's a 1920 restored Chris Craft, and they simply want to display it.
You mentioned some cars becoming classics because a lot of people want to recapture their youth. How about movies and TV? Do they sometimes put a particular make and model in the classic category?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, nothing has probably been more part of film and television history than the Corvette. Movies made about it, television, of course, Route 66, the classic. But, you know, when you think about films and television programs, they do take certain automobiles and they put them into a new category by visualizing it. We're not going to forget, you know, Steve McQueen riding through the streets of San Francisco in Bullet. You know, you can remember that. There's a wonderful film called Corvette Summer about a group of high school kids who rebuild a Corvette they find in a junkyard, and it gets stolen, and they track it down. But and it's a lovely film, but it talks about all these same issues we've been discussing.
Now, how about here in Wisconsin? We've got a lot of year that's really hostile to, as Albrecht said, the battle against entropy when it comes to cars. Do we have a thriving classic car scene here in the state?
Oh, I think so. I think it's pretty much, you've got cruising nights all over Wisconsin, you know, and people want to display their cars. They want to show them off. And, you know, it's Main Street USA, you know, every Friday night or Tuesday night or whatever night, they decide to host these rallies. Consider Road America. I mean, right in the heartland of Wisconsin, Road America has vintage car races. I mean, it's one of its hallmarks. It's not the only kind of racing it has, of course, but people bring their vintage cars to the track. They drive them very often to the track, by the way, and then they race them on that track. And again, part of it is to show their own mechanical skills of getting this car perfectly tuned, but it's also showing off their other or the beauty of it all, you know, the aesthetic qualities about that. So I think automobile culture, vintage or other, is very much alive in Wisconsin.
Michael, I'll put you on the spot. Money's no object. What's your dream car?
I think my dream car is a 1998 Corvette.
1998 Corvette. We'll leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Michael Marsden, emeritus professor at St. Norbert College, talking about classic car culture. Veronica, I was telling you the other day, I'm not really a classic car guy. Cars are very much functional to me. Do you, though, have a dream car?
Oh, boy.
You're going to surprise me here? That a part of your personality I didn't know was out there?
I'd like a car other than our Buick with 200,000 miles on it. That's our second car, but still, you know, a point of pride. But no, the Corvette sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, okay, I could go for that. My kids like the Minis.
Those
speaking
are cute
of that
too.
British car show.
Yeah.
I know.